It's all over for CPS. State lawmakers will finish the job of creating a new standalone child welfare agency. Advocates say kids will be the winners.
The biggest problem that we have identified that must be resolved is the backlog. If we don't get that done, and that does take resources, then the agency will continue to fail.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, what the new department will look like. Also, fire season has begun, and a new partnership wants to stop the sparks.
Phoenix is now offering recycling services to businesses, but only a few.
And the anniversary of a one-hit wonder.
It's come to me in the last 5 to 10 years. I would not trade that song for any other song from any other artist.
Plus, a prehistoric tooth and a modern virtual family.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. If you're trying to get an early start to your Memorial Day weekend travel, only one problem spot on Valley Freeways to tell you about. It's I-17 southbound at 7th Street. An accident there is blocking the shoulder. Look for partly sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 88 degrees. Partly sunny skies as well right through the weekend. Warming up, though, we could reach triple digits by Memorial Day. Right now, it's sunny and 85 degrees.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is reconsidering its stance on the proposed Rosemont copper mine in southern Arizona. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the agency will be taking a closer look at the mine's impact on endangered species.
The open-pit copper mining project has been in the works since 2007. Last fall, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said the proposed mine would not jeopardize the recovery of the area's endangered species. But the agency is rethinking that now. The agency's Steve Spangle says new information about withdrawing groundwater was one factor that triggered the review.
There are a number of aquatic species that we analyzed that we would want to look at this new analysis to see whether it's reasonably certain that those species would be affected to a greater degree than what we had originally considered.
Spangle says the sighting of an endangered ocelot in the area was another factor in the decision. This is the latest delay in what's been a long approval process. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A state court decision says people who voluntarily take part in online gambling can't use Arizona's anti-racketeering law to sue websites operators to recover their losses. The state court of appeals decision upholds a Maricopa County Superior Court judge's ruling against a man who had sued several operators of gambling websites after he lost $800,000.
Hundreds of firefighters continue to battle the slide fire in and around Oak Creek Canyon between Sedona and Flagstaff. The situation has improved a bit with containment at 5% and the possibility of rain in the weekend weather forecast. KJZZ reporter Laurel Morales is in Flagstaff and has the latest.
The fire has grown to 7,500 acres. That's where it is right now, at least. And Incident Command is calling it 5% contained. Firefighters contained several small spot fires last night. That's when, you know, some of the erratic winds pushed embers up onto the crown of trees, and they spotted over the fire line, but they were able to contain them. You know, they're dealing with rough terrain, erratic winds, and a 30% chance of thunderstorms today. That typically means isolated showers and possible dry lightning. But this is the number one priority in the Southwest. That's what we were told last night. We've got 840 fire personnel fighting this fire, and that includes a DC-10, which can now actually drop retardant. The fire's gone high enough up the ridge that it can drop retardant down on those flames.
When residents have the potential of having their lives completely upended, obviously this is a very emotional situation. What can you tell us about last night, residents, folks who live in the community? What was their reaction? What did they have to say?
You know, I think many of them are grateful for all of the firefighters' efforts. But at the same time, they're also really upset with the Forest Service that the forest isn't closed. Right now, we're in Type 1 fire restriction mode. So there's Type 1, Type 2, and then closed. Type 1, campfires are allowed in designated rings. Type 2, no campfires at all, no chainsaws. And closed is obviously nobody's allowed in there. So they were upset that especially with the forest as their backyard, and so many people in Flagstaff, you know, we chose to move here, but there are risks involved with that. But, you know, the forest is our backyard, and every year we seem to have this concern, why isn't the forest closed? And they explained that, you know, there are economic factors, there are loggers, but there's also a measure. You know, they're looking at different models, and we haven't reached that fuel trigger point yet. However, Apache Sitgraves apparently has, because they announced today that they are in Type 2 mode.
And I presume the concern over not being in Type 2 mode, that concern is increased because of the Memorial Day weekend.
Exactly. Many people go camping in the woods during Memorial Day weekend. And, you know, the Wallow Fire, Arizona's largest in history, two campers thought that their campfire was out. They buried it, they poured water over it, and still an ember ignited a dry root. And they'll be paying that $3.7 million in restitution for the rest of their lives.
That's KJZZ's Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
The slide fire was human-caused, and according to the National Interagency Fire Center, people are responsible for more than 62,000 fires in the U.S. every year. It's against that backdrop that several agencies in Arizona, including the State Department of Transportation, Bureau of Land Management, and National Park Service, are teaming up for the One Less Spark, One Less Wildfire campaign. ADOT spokesman Doug Ninsel says the focus is on what drivers can do to prevent fires.
The key thing is we see all too often a problem with folks thinking that there's a problem with their vehicle and they need to pull over, and they don't think about the fact that they're pulling over into an area with some grasses or brush, and those hot engine parts, those hot vehicle parts on the underside of a vehicle, they can spark a fire. And I think one of the other issues is actually the fact that you can have sparks created along a highway from vehicles that have chains that are dragging. So one of the things that we're going to be focusing on will be asking folks, if you have a trailer behind your vehicle, make sure that the chain that's involved there, that if you're using a tow chain in any way, make sure it's not dragging on the pavement, because that can create the sparks that wind up getting into the grasses right next to the highway, and that's where the problem starts. The next thing you know, we have a grass fire that's spreading. And we saw just this past week a recreational vehicle that apparently had some sort of an engine fire, and the owner of that RV wound up pulling over onto the shoulder of I-17 near Sunset Point Rest Area, and the next thing you know, the grasses are on fire, sparking a more than 100-acre fire, a four-hour closure of the highway. So we're just asking folks to keep that in mind.
Is there a feeling people might pay even more close attention in the midst of a fire people are paying a lot of attention to right now?
I really think that it certainly can't hurt to be kicking this off at this time. There is a lot of focus on the slide fire, but we know that we're also on a busy travel weekend, and so that's really why we want to get the word out as well. This is the kickoff to the traditional summer travel season. This is the time for folks who have travel plans to really be thinking about the steps they can take to prevent a wildfire from breaking out right along the side of a highway.
ADOT spokesman Doug Ninsel.
State lawmakers will be back at the Capitol next week for a special session to create the new Department of Child Safety. That new standalone agency will replace Child Protective Services. This comes after the revelation late last year that more than 6,500 reports of child abuse and neglect went uninvestigated. The plan calls for $60 million, and State Representative Kate Brophy-McGee, who was part of the group that worked on the plan, says even though lawmakers have spent money on CPS in the past, this time will be different.
It has to be different. I think with the work of the CARE team, which I was also a part of, all the way through this working group, and then with Flanagan and his folks getting in there and digging in, I think we were able to identify what happened, where it was happening, what's going wrong, and then address it from a policy perspective. It is absolutely critical that the funding accompany that. The biggest problem that we have identified that must be resolved is the backlog. If we don't get that done, and that does take resources, then the agency will continue to fail.
One of the provisions in the governor's plan allows for, it looks like, some kind of privatization. Is there any thought that this is something that the state wants to be looking at?
I think it is very important that we not preclude our options. And a good example of that would be the backlog. And we've got some assumptions about what that backlog consists of. But there may be components of that could be addressed with a public-private partnership. There may be components of the hotline function that could be addressed with a public-private partnership. I'm not certain what will come out of it, but it's important that we have those options.
Another of the interesting provisions allows investigators to look into adults in a child's home who are not necessarily related to those kids. What's the significance of that?
If a child is being harmed and the perpetrator cannot be identified, it does not negate the harm, but the statute and actions to be taken, the statutes need to reflect that, and they have not.
Are you satisfied at the list of programs and services that will be staying at DES and those that will be migrating to the new agency?
I am at this point, but I think that's something that we need to monitor very closely to make sure that the necessary services are available and that the communications between DES and the new agency are open and if there is a good flow of information. It actually was one of my biggest hesitancies about removing the agency from DES was the creation of those silos. But at the same time, even within the agency, those silos existed.
In talking to your colleagues, do you get the sense that a majority of them are on board with this plan? I mean, do you expect rancorous debate on this next week? Do you think that things will go pretty smoothly?
Well, it's certainly my hope that things will go smoothly. I know that any number of them are uncomfortable about the money that we've put in that, in turn, appears to have not yielded results. So there's certainly a push for accountability, and there's certainly a push for transparency. I believe that the budget proposal and the legislation reflects that.
State Representative Kate Brophy McGee. For more on the plan, we turn now to Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services, who's seen his share of reforms to the state's child welfare agency over the years.
We have monkeyed with this agency now. Heck, I've been covering this place for 30 years. And we've always been trying to fix it. And in some ways, it's been patchwork. A little money here, a little revamping there. And I think that the belief is that you need to essentially destroy it to save it, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Have you gotten the sense that the amount of money that this will take is causing heartburn among any legislators?
I think that there wasn't much of a surprise about the $60 million figure. Let's start off with the fact that the governor had requested $80 million in January for the agency and the creation of a new agency. She got $59 million with lawmakers saying, look, let's see what happens when we create the new agency in terms of what's really needed. So we knew there was going to be $21 million right there. Now, beyond that, I think there was also an expectation that there was going to need to be some additional money for subsidized child care. Beyond that, I think there are a lot of lawmakers who, like Representative John Kavanaugh, say, we are not the experts. We have to depend somewhat on the agency to tell us what it needs. And then obviously we'll be monitoring it to find out if they do what they've promised.
Does it seem like this is going to be a package of bills that sort of sails through easily? I mean, does it seem like there's going to be a lot of opposition to this?
Oh, I don't think there'll be a lot of opposition. I think there'll be some questions raised. There may be some tinkering around the edges. I mean, this is a variant on the perennial discussion about the role of CPS. Is it to protect children at all costs, which means the moment you've got a problem, you yank the child from the home, or is it to preserve the family at all costs and try to provide them the services, which of course requires money? And that will become part of the discussion. Is there too much or too little focus on making this into criminal charges? Is there too much or too little focus on prevention? But I think everyone believes that this is a good compromise. In other words, not everyone got everything he or she wanted, but nobody got left out.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks.
You're very welcome.
The city of Phoenix says its trucks drive 4 million miles a year picking up trash, but during their travels, those trucks don't stop at businesses or apartment and condo buildings. KJZZ's Nick Blumberg reports on why that is and whether that might change.
Welcome. Hi, everybody.
It's a Monday night, the monthly meeting of the Roosevelt Row Merchants Association.
Guests today from the city of Phoenix.
One of them came to make a presentation on a program offering city recycling services to local businesses.
The city of Phoenix is prohibited from doing business directly with commercial entities. However, we can extend our services to nonprofit organizations.
It was a little hard to hear in there. If you couldn't understand that, Phoenix is prevented from offering trash and recycling pickup to commercial entities, businesses, and most apartment buildings. It's written into the city code, though nobody I talked to was sure why. Phoenix can provide recycling for nonprofits like the Roosevelt Row Merchants Association. A six-month trial program for neighborhood businesses kept 15 tons of material out of landfills, according to the city. Now, Phoenix is offering recycling pickup for Roosevelt Row businesses on an ongoing basis, which makes neighborhood leader Greg Esser a happy man.
I think the only reason more people haven't participated is simply the lack of ways to physically and logistically participate in recycling.
One of the businesses using Phoenix for recycling is Short Leash Hot Dogs, which hosted the merchants group. Owner Kat Moore says her location on Roosevelt also takes deliveries for a pop-up restaurant and for two food trucks.
That's basically like four restaurants in one place that we have to get food for.
And that means a lot of recycled material.
A lot of boxes, a lot of bottles and cans, and then there's potential compost as well.
Phoenix has a goal of diverting 40% of waste from landfills by the year 2020. Right now, the diversion rate is 18%. Assistant Public Works Director John Trujillo says the city's partnering with Arizona State to reach that goal in a few years.
Either with new programs, which we're talking about today, commercial and multifamily, or new technology development and utilizing the material differently than burying it.
This is also about money. Trujillo points out the city sells some of the recyclable material it picks up.
The net revenue is about $5 million.
And that money helps keep monthly waste collection fees down. Without it,
we would need to add an additional $1.37.
So could offering recycling services for businesses and multifamily homes citywide bring in even more money? Trujillo says,
in discussions with the other cities, that is correct.
Phoenix is the most populous city in Arizona. Of the other cities who round out the top 10, seven of them offer recycling services to businesses and multifamily homes. In order for Phoenix to join their ranks, it'd take city council action.
If we were going to make changes in the business recycling policy, we would really want to hear from the business community that that's something they'd like to see happen.
Councilwoman Kate Gallego.
It's frustrating for folks who want to do the right thing and don't have the option. There's some private sector partners who don't offer as many services as the city does.
To be sure, there would be complications to smooth out if Phoenix started offering commercial recycling. They'd likely need more staff and the right kinds of equipment. There'd also be small-scale concerns, like what size containers businesses can get and how often they'll get picked up. That's what Kat Moore with Short Leash Hot Dogs wants to know. She says recycling bins take up space in an already tiny parking lot.
Unless we have people eating, we don't have any trash to throw away. So it's kind of a, you know, full circle. I need people to eat, and then I'll deal with their trash.
Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Still to come, we celebrate the anniversary of a musical classic.
I can't really see any stage that I would go on to, regardless of who I was opening for, where Bust a Move wouldn't be the biggest song of the night, period.
Get your baggy pants ready. It's the show.
Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. It is the show, a KJZZ original production, blending news from the community with national and international stories. Quick check of Valley traffic accidents, I-17 southbound at 7th Street. There's also a collision 101 southbound in the East Valley at Guadalupe. Looks like a nice weekend with high temperatures starting tomorrow in the low 90s, making the upper 90s by Sunday. It's currently 85 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Dignity Health. Proud to introduce Norton Thoracic Institute at Dignity Health St. Joseph's Hospital, a new era of lung, heart, and esophageal care. More about the Institute at dignityhealth.org/thoracic.
Are you a lark or an owl, an early riser or productive late into the night? You probably know the answer, but do you pay attention to your own personal body clock when you have to get to the office or have the school run to sort out? The BBC's James Gallagher has been to a town in rural Germany where they're trying to slow down and order their lives around the natural rhythm of our internal body clocks.
I'm starting my tour of Bad Kissingen with a taste of the local mineral water. That definitely has a salty kick. But they serve it up here with the flair of a cocktail waiter, all for its reported health benefits. It's a very old idea, but they're about to try something really new. A chrono city, and I'm here to meet the visionary behind the project.
My name is Michael Wieden, and I initiated the project Chrono City about 1.5 years ago.
I suppose the big question to start off with is why?
We have these high-speed cities like Frankfurt, like Berlin, like Munich, and we want to be on the other side of this. We want to be a slow city that respects the inner clock. The town benefits in several ways. To get an idea how the inner clock works, they can try to change things in their life. When we change the way of thinking, this will be the success.
We're here in the Altschlotter Haus of Bad Kissingen.
The scientific brains behind the project, Dr. Thomas Kantermann, took me to the cathedral-like building, which will become a centre for body clock research.
The unique thing here is that we have the opportunity to bring all the knowledge we have from very sophisticated, good lab studies into the field and find out how does modern society challenge our body clocks. Even little sleep is the biggest stress and health risk we have these days.
I'm taking a stroll around this traditional Bavarian town. It's a gloriously sunny day, and it's the sun up there that helps set everyone's body clock. Just coming up on the right is the town hall. They're trying to introduce more natural lights to see if it improves the mood of people working there. Just over the bridge in front of me, there's a clinic trying to let patients lie in longer in the mornings to see if it helps improve their response to treatment. There's lots of these little projects popping up in the town, and even the hotels are getting in on the act.
Guten Abend.
Hello, I'm James Gallagher. I'm here to check in.
Hello, Mr. Gallagher. We note that you're a late chronotype and we reserved a room for you.
My preference for late nights and lie-ins mean I'm classified as an owl type. So I get a room with no sun in the morning to help me sleep in.
Here's your room key.
Thank you. It's all well and good giving me an owl room, but real life's managing to get in the way already. It's 7:45 a.m. and I'm heading to the local high school. Lessons start in 10 minutes' time. Life begins early here in Germany, no matter what your body clock is.
Good morning, girls and boys.
Good morning.
And now let's read our text.
Teenagers may have a lazy image for lying in until noon, but it's down to a shift in their body clock which keeps them up late. The school knows students are yawning their way through the early lessons, so they want to move exams to later in the day, and the pupils are also taking part in experiments to boost their sleep.
For 1 or 2 weeks we had sleep with the blinds open.
It's more natural.
It was unusual, but I actually found I was able to sleep better.
How do you find getting up in the morning to come to school?
I hate it. I'm better at school if I can sleep longer.
Just across town, the Schmidt family bakery has a different challenge. The staff worked shifts to produce loaves, buns and pastries 24 hours a day. Its manager Johannes wants to bring body clock science to the bakery, but says whole-scale change is unlikely.
I think it's interesting for everyone to know what kind of chronotype I am. I don't know how we can organize it. Everybody will work to his own best time. That's not realistic, I think. But we can see where we have opportunities to make them things better.
The chimes of the church clock mark the end of my time in Bad Kissingen. They're a final reminder that even here, it's the time set by society that rules our lives. But if this project discovers new ways of living in tune with the body clock, there could be lessons for all of us.
That's the BBC's James Gallagher.
I'm not sure how many of you would have been awake to know it, but the sun rose in the valley at 5:22 this morning. And with the intense brightness of that sun over the long sizzling summer, our body clocks are affected. Also, if your sleep pattern is already out of sync, the next few months could hit you especially hard. Dr. Lois Cron is a sleep expert at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix.
At this time of year, the sun is rising quite early. And especially for people who do not have very good drapes, who have large windows, they may find it very difficult to sleep past sunrise. And when sunrise is early, people may be awoken much earlier than they really want.
Are there certain tricks that we can play on the body to make sure that we're at less of a disadvantage when it comes to either a lack of sleep or a time of sleep?
There are all sorts of devices that have been tried. Some of the ones that work better are very good quality window blinds, or even sleeping in a room in the house that doesn't have a great exposure, so perhaps has a view onto a wall and doesn't get much light at the best of times. You know, for a person who's working odd hours, that might be the preferred bedroom, even if it's not really the master bedroom. Night patches can help some people. Others find them uncomfortable to wear night after night. Some people will take melatonin, a supplement, to try and help their body stay on a set schedule, especially if it's not the same schedule as most of the people around them.
What about someone who works very different hours, either an overnight shift or the very early morning shift? How do those people keep from getting too out of sync with what the rest of the community is doing?
Well, someone with a schedule like that does have a mismatch with everyone in the community in this part of the world. You know, he might be on East Coast time, so it's not out of sync with other parts of the country, just where he happens to be living. The body responds best to consistency. So if someone is always getting up at 3 o'clock, it becomes easier to do it. A person who has to keep odd hours is having to ignore cues that help everyone else. And the most powerful cue is sunlight or artificial light. And, you know, a person who gets up at 3 in the morning, gets up in the dark, can't wait until dawn, and likely has to go to bed before the sun sets. So the most powerful cue of all is not available to help that person.
Dr. Cron, coming back specifically to where we live here in the desert Southwest, many people, as it gets hotter, as we know it will soon, like to get up especially early because they want to make sure that perhaps they want to take a jog or a hike or take the dog for a walk, for example, knowing that they'll either be at work or knowing they can't do it at 7 o'clock because it's already 90 degrees at that point. How can people find a balance? Let's say for 8 months of the year, they get up at 6:30 or 7, and there's 3 or 4 months they're getting up at 5 or 5:30. How does that affect the body clock potentially?
That's not a big issue, as long as it's week after week. So when we're talking about changes measured in months, the human body is able to adapt. After all, much of the country does daylight savings time, and the whole society shifts their body clock only by an hour, but it's still a shift. So it is possible to sort of have a different schedule during the hot summer months than during the cooler part of the year. It's much more problematic if a person has a certain schedule for, let's say, 5 days a week and then changes their sleep pattern for 2 days over the weekend. That has more of a consequence.
Dr. Lois Cron is a sleep expert at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Angie McIntyre. I work for the Arizona Game and Fish Department as the Bat Management Coordinator, and I'm here at the 40th Street and Camelback Flood Control Tunnel getting ready to watch the bats as they emerge at sunset like they do each night through the summer. Usually what happens is one or two will start to kind of fly out a little bit, kind of test the waters, and then just like a burst, they'll just all start to come out. Just a really nice, quiet way to spend a few minutes. It doesn't cost anything. A lot of people don't realize that this is here. It's an easy place to get to, and it's a great way to see wildlife right here in our urban environment.
Angie McIntyre watching the bats emerge at sunset at the floodgate off 40th Street north of Camelback in Phoenix. If you hear things that sound unique to our city, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
Still to come, Phoenix Fire has seen a dramatic increase in the number of calls for rescues at the city's mountain preserves.
When we have a very busy day out here and we spend, you know, 3 or 4 hours out here, that's 3 or 4 hours that we pull from someplace inside of the community that needs a response.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Few problem spots on Valley Freeway's I-17 southbound at 7th Street, 101 southbound at Guadalupe in the East Valley, and the 60 eastbound at Stapley. Should be a sunny Memorial Day weekend for you with a high today of 88, warming up to 91 tomorrow. Then we could see triple digits by Memorial Day on Monday. It's 86 degrees right now at 234.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering USDA Prime New York strip steaks, summer wines, and flag fruit tarts for Memorial Day gatherings. A list of 11 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
Video games and social commentary usually intersect only when it comes to violence and whether real-life behavior is affected by playing Grand Theft Auto or Call of Duty. But Mesa teenage gamer Ty Marini recently called out Nintendo for not recognizing same-sex relationships in its Tomodachi Life game. Marini put together an online plea.
In the game, Miis will fall in love, and they can even get married too. And there are specific features and content that you can't access without getting married, such as moving into a bigger house of your own, having a child and sending them off to other islands via street pass, etc. That sounds pretty cool, right? Well, it probably is for most people, but there's a problem. The game does not support same-sex relationships.
When the game was originally announced in Japan, I wasn't really surprised, mainly because it's coming from Japan. The culture's a little bit different there. It's unfortunate, but it wasn't necessarily something I expected. I had hoped, especially after the first game in the series that never made it outside of Japan, didn't support it either. That's when I felt like, you know, it might be worth raising awareness of this issue.
Ty, describe the game a little bit more. What makes this a suitable one for talking about same-sex relationships?
This game has such a big emphasis on relationships, and it's a more personal game featuring characters that you create based on you and your friends. You know, the fact that same-sex relationships are excluded really, limits the immersion and fun that a lot of people can experience within the game. So that's why I decided to make a video, basically kindly asking Nintendo to change things in the future, whether that be an update to the current game or make sure the next game in the series supports it. And that's what it did. And the campaign got a lot of attention. Nintendo even responded.
Okay. What was the response?
Their first response was more of a non-answer. They basically said that they weren't trying to make social commentary. And that response kind of backfired, stirred up a lot of controversy. However, Nintendo's second response was much better. They actually apologized for excluding same-sex relationships, and they pledged that future games in the Tomodachi series, if they make any, will be more inclusive. They'll strive to make more future entries more inclusive, of course, including same-sex relationships or whatever they need to do to make the game more inclusive.
To what extent do you think, if at all, this could be kind of a turning point overall in the industry, the fact that you put this message out, that people responded so positively to it, and you actually even got a response from a major corporation?
Well, I certainly hope that it can influence the video game industry positively. You know, LGBT awareness or equality in general. It's already encouraged a lot of, started a lot of discussion among the video game industry. A lot of people are talking about it. It's kind of become an even bigger issue than just Tomodachi Life. So it's definitely having some kind of influence on the industry, and I hope that the movement will make these issues less common or, not come up in the future at all.
Mesa gamer and gaming activist Ty Marini.
May is Mental Health Month, and we've talked to Jim Dunn of the National Alliance of Mental Illness in Arizona about what challenges those with mental illness still face.
Now we'll hear an essay from S.E. Smith, who is a freelance writer and the social justice editor for the online magazine XO Jane, and also openly identifies as living with mental illness.
When you're mentally ill, everything you say and do is viewed through the lens of your illness. When you're upset about something, People say it's because you're crazy. When you're having a difficult day, or a great one, people say it's because you're bipolar. When you're struggling, people always say it's because you're mentally ill, and not because of larger, more complicated factors. So you become very good at three things: hiding your illness, questioning yourself, and putting up a front. You become very selective in terms of who you out yourself to and when. If you do it too soon, suddenly you will be discounted and devalued. You'll never get a call back after that nice date. Your boss will find ways to hassle you. Your voice will be quietly pushed to the back of group conversations. If you do it too late, you'll be accused of lying, when the truth is about something more simple. It's self-protection. You are also constantly questioning yourself. Do I feel this way because this is a legitimate thing to be angry or sad or happy about? Or is this my illness? You ask, and you ask it all the time. Crazy people are some of the most self-aware. You have to be, because otherwise you run the risk of allowing your emotions to run rampant. And you become proficient in the art of fronting. You present a smooth, even face to the world, even if you're falling apart on the inside. You do this in order to keep it together, to avoid detection and discussion. You don't want people to comment on your emotional state, so you lock it up. So you smile when you feel bad and temper your good moods. You feel almost robotic at times because you work to ensure that people never see the rough, unfinished edges of your illness. You've been taught and socialized to understand that society will not make space for you. Instead, you must meld yourself to fit society. But what about those who do not have these skills, who don't have access to therapy, medication, and other treatments that might help them get stable, who don't have homes and support networks? When you pass someone gibbering on a street corner, you reflect on the fact that this could easily be you. This is a society where access to care is predicated on circumstance and privilege, not basic humanity. People want to say that their perceptions don't change when they find out you have a mental illness, but they do. We see the change, and we feel it. We feel it in the subtle edging away, in the sudden denial of our experiences and emotions, in the abrupt assumption that we aren't capable of navigating the world on equal footing.
That's S.E. Smith.
The Phoenix Fire Department is on track to respond to more than 200 rescues in the city's mountain preserves this year. That would be an increase of more than 30 calls from last year. During the first quarter of 2014, the department has fielded twice the calls as the same period last year. Captain Jonathan Jacobs is with Phoenix Fire.
In 2013, we had right around 36 or so, and then right now we had doubled that the first quarter, and then we've kind of blown past that.
To what do you attribute that?
You know what, there's a lot of different things. Part of it is, you know, we go back and we look at the weather. We look at the kind of a mild winter that we had. There was the great hiking weather. But then also we look at Echo Canyon was closed. So we add a large number of people to the different preserve areas, which can cause some problems there. Maybe a lot of preparedness of how somebody is prepared. We usually see kind of a big startup around, you know, January 1, where people really want to get in shape. So we have some of those that we go through. But and then again, there's a lot of, you know, people out and about on the mountain areas, and they get hurt and just basic, you know, injuries.
How do the calls tend to go once it gets really hot during the summer? Do you see more of them? Do you see fewer of them?
We see fewer hikers, but we see about the same number of calls. But what I would tell you is that the severity of the calls is a lot worse.
What does it do to your department's resources to have to be constantly coming out to these mountain preserves and helping people off the mountains?
Most of our mountain rescue calls, I think on average, we're right around 1 hour is what it takes us from start to finish of the call. But what it does is it takes resources out of areas where there's call volume, where they're responding to heart attacks, strokes, and fires. So there's a fine balance in between that. But when we have a very busy day out here and we spend, you know, 3 or 4 hours out here, that's 3 or 4 hours that we pull from someplace inside of the community that needs a response that we have to then figure out logistically how are we going to get other trucks in there, and how do we do that to make sure that we provide that coverage.
In addition to needing to move the trucks around and having people at places maybe they don't need to be, are there other financial costs associated with having to do these mountain rescues?
There's a lot of questions on that. And the number one question is, hey, what does it cost? And for us, for the way that our department actually built this system, we call it special operations. The way that we built this system is basically through FEMA. We have a FEMA team here by the Phoenix Fire Department. It's Arizona Task Force 1. A lot of their training and everything was actually paid for by FEMA.
You know, there's a lot of attention usually around monsoon season about Arizona's stupid motorist law, where if you drive into a flooded area, you basically have to pay for the cost of your extrication. Would something similar be feasible or even needed for hikers?
You know, that's not really the fire department's call on that. Everybody has their opinion. We do get a lot of feedback as we're on the mountain and we're kind of taking care of our gear down. We'll get a lot of feedback from people that are out there that ask that question. And really what comes into play for the Phoenix Fire Department is that we don't want to be enforcers of anything. We can definitely see when somebody has not prepared to be out there or they've done something. But when we look at what we do, everybody makes mistakes. Everybody has the ability to not make good decisions at certain times. What we want is we don't want anybody not to call us because they're afraid they're going to get a ticket.
Captain Jonathan Jacobs is a public information officer with the Phoenix Fire Department. Every so often, you hear something that just makes you feel old. Today, it's this. Come sit next to me, you fine fellow. You run over there without a second to lose. And what comes next? Hey, bust the move. Bust a Move. 25 years ago this week, Bust a Move by Young MC came out. Yep, 25 years. It won him a Grammy and was a top 10 hit on a bunch of Billboard charts, but it was Young MC's only hit. Today, Young MC, whose real name is Marvin Young, lives in the Valley, and I asked him about the rap scene back in the late 80s and early 90s.
It was so open and so, it was just so new because basically there were not a lot of people that had any kind of specific idea of what rap was.
Do you think rap is still as open as it was?
Not in terms of the artist having the ability to break new ground, but it's even more open in terms of the access that the musicians have in terms of where the music can be played, pop culture references, movie licenses, all that stuff. There's a lot more freedom with that than we had back then. We had to kind of break ground with that stuff.
Do you think your music would be as popular had it come out in the last 5 or 10 years as it was when it did?
Well, probably not, and it has little or nothing to do with the music. I mean, to put it in context, I was reading an article back in the early 90s from Garth Brooks, and he said if the Eagles came out in 1991, they would be considered a country act. And I'm not a huge fan of country, but I'm a huge fan of the Eagles, and musically, he's exactly right. So if you take that and you kind of move that up to today, I think if Bust a Move came out today, I don't think it would be as popular. Maybe different production and up to date or whatever, but you don't have the fan support. You don't have the artist development now that you had back then. One of the byproducts of the downloading and the streaming and that is that you don't have physical product in front of you. Everything is so virtual and everything is so disconnected. People don't write fan letters, they type emails or they tweet and hope to get an answer back on Twitter. So all that stuff prevents someone from having the kind of career where you say, okay, what's the next album going to be like, and the next one, and the next one. People are more caught up in who's on the track, who produced the track, what, you know, who guested on it, just all the things besides who the actual artist is.
Does it bug you at all that people mostly know you for that one song?
At the beginning, it did, because three years, five years after Bust a Move, I'm like, I can write something better. I know I can do something better. But I equate this to having a second first girlfriend. As a listener, if you had not heard something like Bust a Move before and you hear it and it affects you in a certain way, you know, that's a special interaction that can't really be duplicated. So I am always asked, are you upset that you weren't able to make a second Bust a Move? And I said, well, I'll be upset about making a second one when somebody else makes another first one. Putting it in total context, if the country has over 300 million people, I would venture to say close to 200 million people know who I am or know who the song is. If I would have asked those 200 million people what their favorite Young MC song was, I'd pretty much know what they'd say. But if I ask them what their favorite LL Cool J or name any artist with a big, catalog of similar popularity songs, you get different answers. So that's the one advantage of being the quote-unquote one-hit wonder, is that when they say that song, which has been all over the place and is in popular culture and all that, when they say that the name of that song, they think about me, and I'm fine with that.
Was it hard to continue doing music after that? I mean, knowing that, and that was a huge hit. It was a top 10 hit on a lot of Billboard charts.
No, I mean, it would be hard continuing to do music if I was prohibited from performing Bust a Move at the end of my show. You know what I mean? It's not like it went away. I still had it, but it wasn't the record that I was promoting at the time. But people would still come to see me because they liked Bust a Move, and I was able to perform new stuff for them that they hadn't heard before. And, you know, most of the time they're in a good mood and they like it, and I get, you know, some downloads, some notoriety from it. I can't really see any stage that I would go on to, regardless of who I was opening for, where Bust a Move wouldn't be the biggest song of the night, period. It's come to me in the last 5 to 10 years. I would not trade that song for any other song from any other artist, just in terms of the longevity it's had, the downloads, the licensing, I mean, all that stuff, not even monetarily, but just the generations. Like, people only, you know, some kids only know it from You, Me, and Dupree, or they only know it from Glee, or they only know it from Can't Hardly Wait. So the fact that it keeps on living like that, I'm ecstatic for it, because there's artists that work a lot harder than I did that can't get that kind of traction, like ongoing traction, yeah.
To what do you attribute its ongoing popularity?
I think because I wrote it when I was in college and I was using big words, that a lot of the nerd kids really identified with it. And then those nerd kids, you know, grow up and they get jobs and they have kids and they say, okay, I don't really want you to listen to a lot of rap music, but you can listen to him.
What brought you to Phoenix?
I came here in a relationship, actually. It's a typical story. I came out in a relationship, didn't work out, and I like it here. You know, and it's easier for me to do business here. I actually can make more inroads with the film stuff that I want to do here than I was in L.A. And it's more just the sheer mass of people, and that everybody goes to L.A. to try to make it happen. So you're tripping over everybody. And with here, I was able to continue my music, continue being creative, and also set up the infrastructure to take advantage of an opportunity like this, where I'm working with ASU, you know, the School of Film, to make my movie Justice Served.
Yeah, tell us about the movie you're working on. This is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's a movie called Justice Served. We're going to start shooting next week, and we're in the midst of getting, wrapping the last things up. It's a thriller, and we have Lance Henriksen, who is an alien. We pretty much have a crew together. We're getting cast together. It's the best thing I've ever written screenplay-wise. I've written like 7 screenplays. And I was able to help out financially, and then the school is helping out with a great deal of infrastructure and student interns and the like. And we're going to have a professional film done by the end of Summer B.
When you're just sort of out and about in town, either here or elsewhere, do people come up to you and recite lyrics or just yell Bust a Move at you?
I mean, it's not usually like that. I you get the look because you age a little bit. I put on some weight. You know, I find the more weight that I lose, the more people recognize you, which is ironic. it's not that as much as I know you or, you know, whatever. And even like TSA agents and stuff like that. It's just really funny.
Like when they see your name or just by looking
at
you?
No, by looking at me. Okay. By looking at me. So it's just really, it's really funny with that.
What are you listening to now?
No, I listen to mostly throwback stuff. I'll listen to classic rock, alternative rock, some older rap, older R&B, instrumentals. You know, it's like driving music. I pick things apart, and a lot of the stuff now is so similar that unless the lyrics are just incredible or the hook is just so catchy, I'm going to get either bored by it or I won't be inspired by it. Basically, I put it like this. With me having Bust a Move, you know, having co-written Wild Thing, co-written Funky Co Medina, co-written this song called Not That Kind for this girl named Anastasia, who was huge overseas. I look at when I hear a song and I really like it, I say, okay, what would I rather have made that song than any one of mine? And it's fewer and fewer times in the last several years that I could say that about anything.
Marvin Young, also known as Young MC, this is the 25th anniversary of Bust a Move. This week is the 25th anniversary. Marvin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In the city, ladies look pretty. Guys tell jokes so they can seem witty. Tell a funny joke just to get some play. Then you try to make a move and she says no way. Girls are faking, goodness saking. They want a man who brings home the bacon.
The Phoenix Police Museum traces the city's history to its earliest days, and as KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us, that history isn't always pretty.
On Washington Street in downtown Phoenix is the Old City Hall. Did you know the six-story building has gone through many changes over the years? Today, it's home to the Phoenix Police Museum.
As people come into the museum, the first thing they're going to see is this jail rock.
Mike Nicolin is a retired Phoenix cop who served 32 years on the force.
Back then, they decided to take the river rock and use that for leg irons to shackle someone to that.
So Nicolin is also the museum's founder. He says when the old City Hall first opened on 2nd Avenue in 1929, it was home to city offices, including the police. By the 1960s, the city moved, and this building was taken over entirely by the police department. In 1975, PD also moved to a larger space, leaving the building barely used. Then, 2 years ago, Nicolin brought the museum here, the same place where he once worked as a detective.
Primarily, the first exhibit deals with Henry Garfias, the city of Phoenix in the late 1800s.
Garfias was the first city marshal.
The weapons that you see are all real.
The exhibition hall is filled with items used by the department over its 100-year history. Handguns and booking reports of people arrested from the early 1900s. In the back of the room is the city's first police helicopter, acquired in 1973.
This helicopter, other than absent of the fuel and oil equipment for it, it would start up and fly right now.
There's also a memorial for every Phoenix officer who died in the line of duty. A sculpture of a police officer that looks like an angel stands above a coffin in the center of the room.
And over here is the Miranda display.
Nicolin is referring to Ernesto Miranda, the Phoenix man at the center of the 1966 Supreme Court case. It led to police nationwide to read Miranda rights to criminal suspects in police custody. The exhibit highlights everything about the case.
And this is what Miranda was fingerprinted on.
What's a police museum without a jail? There is one on the fifth floor. It's been closed for decades, and it's not open to the public, but I got a peek inside.
So to get in here, now this would be the cell area that we would put our...
The place is dusty. Nicolin says hardly anyone comes up here. There are about 30 cells on the floor. Markings on the walls show where beds once hung. A toilet and a sink are all that remains inside each cell. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you have ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. It's the show at kjzz.org.
A few weeks ago, we heard from Rob Gay. He's a paleontologist and teacher at Mission Heights Preparatory High School in Casa Grande. He was taking his class for Utah for a dig, and they actually found something big, scientifically big. Physically, it's actually pretty small. It's a tooth from what Gay calls an enigmatic reptile known as Crosbysaurus. He says scientists don't know what the animal looked like since they've only ever found their teeth. But what makes this discovery important is its location. Before now, these teeth have only been found in Arizona, Texas, and New Mexico, not Utah.
One of the questions that my students and I have been hoping to answer is, how are the animals in Utah related to the animals in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico? And by tying this animal together with our local faunas here in Arizona, it kind of helps complete the picture of what this area was like 220 million years ago.
Gay says the tooth is triangular with large serrations on the back and smaller ones on the front. You can see a picture of it. You might not want to if you're eating, though. It's at kjzz.org.
And we'll help mark Memorial Day weekend on Monday. It'll start on Saturday with a Memorial Day ride and after party. Starts at 8 a.m. at 51st Avenue in Glendale to honor fallen heroes.
Also tonight, Movie Madness in the Park at Santan Regional Park in Queen Creek. You can watch The Adventures of Milo and Otis inside the Nature Center.
And whether you pronounce it Caribbean or Caribbean, it's the third annual Phoenix Carnival Parade. That's on Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Park Central Mall in Phoenix.
Also tomorrow, Arts and Smarts in the City at Bookman's Entertainment Exchange from 2 to 4 features events on literacy and learning activities.
The show was produced this week by Sarah Ventry, Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer is our digital media editor. Our managing editor, Al Macias. The news director is Peter O'Dowd. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
We also always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody for Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next. It's 3 o'clock.